The COVID-19 pandemic has created an economic crisis for many of us. So much so that a recent New York Times advertisement called on the Biden administration to offer $2,400 direct payments to American mothers for the unpaid labor of childcare and homeschooling. But working mothers aren't the only group that have been the focus of a campaign for cash payments. The concept of universal basic income has slowly gained support among some politicians across the country. Andrew Yang, a current candidate for mayor of New York City and a former presidential candidate, made the concept a key part of his campaign.
If you were to put $1,000 a month in their hands, they use it in the most positive and beneficial way possible.
And close to a dozen U.S. mayors are experimenting with some type of income payment to constituents. I'm Tanzina Vega, and breaking down universal basic income amid the pandemic is where we start today on The Takeaway. Sarah Holder is a staff writer at City Lab covering local policy, affordable housing, labor, and technology. Sarah, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Amy Castro-Baker is an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the co-director of the Center for Guaranteed Income Research. Amy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, let's start with you. Lots of terms floating around. Let's get a basic explainer. What is the difference between universal basic income and guaranteed income?
Right. So there are a lot of terms floating around to describe the concept that we're talking about, which is money paid monthly, no strings attached, to people in a community. So universal basic income, as you might expect, is paid out to everyone in a country, in a city. And a guaranteed basic income sort of follows along the lines of civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr., who talked about having enough to pay your bills every month. A lot of cities right now are talking about a guaranteed income to sort of live on from that civil rights legacy of economic justice and move it away from some of the more automation-focused concepts. And what we're seeing in a lot of cities right now is that the basic income payments are not universal. They're going specifically to low-income families that need the additional support. So that's the key difference that we're seeing right now.
Amy, when we talk about these two philosophies, guaranteed income versus universal basic income, guaranteed obviously coming with some measures that one has to meet versus universal where everybody gets a base payment here, is there a difference in terms of the benefit of either one of these programs?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it's hard to say if there's a benefit of one over the other because we haven't had a truly universal basic income experiment yet. So, you know, I come at it from the perspective of a researcher and what are the research questions we can answer and how do we actually generate evidence-based policy around this? So it's hard to say. I think the bigger question around universal basic income versus guaranteed income is which one is more politically palatable right now in the United States, you know, number one. And then number two, figuring out if you're going to actually design it at scale, what would it cost, you know, in reality?
So let's talk a little bit about that, because this seems to be this isn't new, Amy. I mean, this is something that people have been talking about for decades.
Correct. Yeah, no, it's not new at all.
So Sarah, how are cities looking to implement these different programs? Are most cities looking at universal basic income, the cities that we know that where mayors are really taking it, or like talking about it like Andrew Yang was? Or are cities looking at this where there's interest in doing it and looking at guaranteed income?
Right. And Dr. Baker talked about that right now, all we're really seeing in the United States are these guaranteed income experiments. She was heavily involved with Stockton, California's experiment, which was one of the first and sort of the biggest in the United States, which started with 125 families. The rest of the cities that we're seeing come out sort of in this model are focusing on hundreds of families. So Compton, California will be running one of the largest with 800 families. Hudson, New York is running one with just 25 families. So there's a broad range, but most of them focus specifically on very low income families, either identified through documentation or through, you know, their census tract. Some are focusing specifically on populations that have slipped through the cracks traditionally. So in San Francisco, there's a pilot running to focus on Black and Pacific Islander mothers during pregnancy and 6 months thereafter. So we're seeing a range of projects that are really targeted, but that honor sort of the basic goal of these projects, which is unconditional cash. And another thing that you know, sets them apart is that they typically have a sunset period.
Well,
let me just stop
you there, Sarah, because unconditional cash would mean universal, right? That would mean anybody and everybody is eligible for this. But there are conditions for guaranteed basic income.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think it's sort of testing the idea of unconditional being you don't have to spend the money a specific way, you know, as opposed to other welfare programs where you might have to spend it on housing or on food or on specific kind of food. I guess the unconditional is more talking about the lack of strings attached to the cash once you get it.
Interesting. Amy, Sarah just mentioned the W word right there. I grew up in the 80s and 90s and remember in a very low income community and remember the concept of welfare being something that was demonized in many areas and really sort of stereotyped in very negative ways. Does that transfer to the political will or lack thereof around either one of these programs, Amy, whether it's guaranteed income or universal basic income, particularly universal basic income?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, and you're right. We have absolutely saddled most safety net benefits in the United States with a lot of shame and blame and kind of the strong binary between who's deserving and who's undeserving. And the real ethos behind guaranteed income or basic income is saying you're deserving because you're human. There's this floor that we will not let you fall beneath because you are a citizen. And I think that there is a new way that people are talking about that idea of deservedness simply because we've kind of reached a breaking point, right? And so we had the Great Recession. Most families have not recovered from the loss of wealth during the Great Recession, particularly homeowners in, you know, working class communities. And then, of course, we have the pandemic on top of that, right? So you have a growing number of families who are working more and making less. And that's basically pushing us away from sort of these ways that we used to talk about things like social safety net, the social contract, into new ways of reimagining how we want to take care of one another, given the real dire economic strain that most U.S. households are experiencing.
Amy, I want to dig a little deeper there, because the concept, I think, for a lot of folks of is universal basic income or guaranteed income, it almost feels like it's emerging at a time, as you mentioned, the pandemic and people having not recovered from the Great Recession. But we also know that hourly wages have not kept pace with inflation, and Social Security is something that a lot of folks are not feeling that they're going to be able to rely on. So do those economic indicators also point towards the need for some sort of cash payment?
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, without question, right, is that, you know, when we look at people, you know, particularly millennials, they're the first generation in U.S. history to be projected to do worse off than their parents financially, right? And that's just one, you know, quick indicator. But yeah, these systems that we have set up for families to, you know, be financially stable, achieve some degree of upward mobility are largely crumbling. And it sort of demands a new way of thinking about it. And the thing I'd like to say sort of that really differentiates guaranteed income or UBI from some of these other programs like SSI or, you know, housing, that type of thing, is the fact that it's flexible, right? And so the other marker of the economy right now, as these other institutions are really under strain, is that what people need really fluctuates from month to month. So one month it might be housing, the next month it might be food, the next month it might be, you know, needs around transportation or childcare. And so the idea is if you have cash is flexible and that can meet the needs of families, which are flexible, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we get rid of all those other programs, right? And so the other thing that I'm seeing with these cities that are designing new basic income experiments is they're designing them to work alongside the safety net, not in place of it.
Sarah, let's talk. We talked a little bit about California, what's happening in LA County, but what about what's happening in Jackson, Mississippi? How is that pilot program working out?
Yeah, so you're talking about the Magnolia Mothers Projects in Jackson, Mississippi, that started a couple years ago with just 20 women mothers, and then it expanded to reach 110 women. Women there were given $1,000 a month, and what they found was that, you know, collectively the mothers were able to pay off $10,000 in debt. Many of them slept better, were less stressed. Again, this was a small project, really really targeted at a specific community. And, you know, a lot of women were able to benefit from the project. I mean, speaking about some of the limitations of projects like these, I know a lot of women were, you know, a bit wary of participating in a program like this in the beginning, worried that it might kick them off of other specific benefits, other welfare benefits, because they could make too much money to qualify. I think that's been a project of a lot of the researchers around universal basic income to make sure that people know that these aren't replacements for other welfare programs and make sure they can put them into sort of a cocktail of other benefits.
Amy, there's wavering support, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on political support for either of these. We know Andrew Yang in particular and mayors across the country have made some efforts to do this, but I'm curious about Americans what they think about this. We know that, for example, $1,400 stimulus checks have definitely gotten many Americans on board with that idea for the pandemic as a one-time payment, but they seem to be mixed on whether or not we should have some sort of universal basic income or guaranteed income. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so, you know, the pandemic has definitely created this shift where we see, you know, changes in polling on both the right and the left around palatability for cash. The question is how and why, right? So, you know, when it comes to basic income, it's one of those things that it's so, so rare, but it garners support from both the right and the left. So I think that there is tremendous opportunity for bipartisan support. It is one of the few ideas that I've ever worked on in the social policy space where I have people interested on both sides of the political aisle. Now, how you can
why is that?
It,
I suppose why is
why
that?
Why is it?
Yeah, because poverty cuts across for all Americans, isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, poverty cuts across both sides, but I think there's motivation for it for two different reasons. From my perspective, what I see on the left is it tends to be part of the way that people view economic justice, so addressing structural injustice in the market. And on the right, it tends to be, you know, more ideas around efficiency and also not wanting the government to be involved in means-tested benefits. So, you know, there's obviously wiggle room on both of those sides, but, you know, on the left, it tends to be more about structural inequality, and on the right, it tends to be more thinking around the lines of how can we make government function better with less strings and less bureaucracy.
We're going to have to leave it there, but Dr. Amy Castro-Baker is an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and Sarah Holder is a staff writer at CityLab. Sarah and Amy, thanks to you both.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, your turn. What do you think about universal basic income?
My worry is that a universal basic income or even a city-based basic income would simply be a band-aid approach to income inequality without addressing the outrageous inflation of costs for things like housing, healthcare, and education that really contribute to income inequality. So without a way of getting away from privatized healthcare and education, for example, the income would simply create an underclass of people who would still have no access to any form of social mobility.
More of your calls coming up later in the show. We've been talking about the push for guaranteed and universal basic income in the United States and what the COVID-19 pandemic has meant for its popularity. The current wave of popularity has been spurred by a two-year pilot program launched in Stockton, California in February 2019. Michael Tubbs, former mayor of Stockton, California, gained national attention for the program, and though he's since been voted out of office, he's still leading the charge on the issue as the founder of Mayors for a Guaranteed Income. Michael, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hello.
Why did you start the program?
I started the program because I think poverty is immoral. And as mayor, all the issues we talked about in Stockton, from homelessness to educational attainment to violent crime, were symptoms of an issue with intractable poverty. When we had about a fourth of residents living in poverty, about another half, one paycheck away, it just seemed to me that as mayor, one of the most important things we could do was to figure out how do we really solve for poverty? And then we'll see changes in all these other issues.
So tell me how your program actually worked. Was it guaranteed income? Was it universal basic income? Who was it meant to serve?
It was a guaranteed income demonstration only because we did not have the resources to provide a basic income to every single person who lived in Stockton. But what we did, and I think Dr. Amy was on before me, is that we found a way to make it so that up to 75% of the city qualified. So as close to universal as possible by using census tract data. And from that pool of 75% of Stockton residents, we were able to get down to 125 who represent the city in age and diversity and employment status and in income.
What were the effects that you saw that came from that program?
So the effects are actually coming out next month. And Dr. Amy would kill me if I revealed the little that I know. But I would say, in terms of what's publicly available, we saw that people spend money the way you and I spend money. That people spend money on food and utilities, and increasingly so during COVID-19. And then there's also a couple of stories from some folks in the program that really highlight, I think, the agency that guaranteed income gives people. One young man, Tomas, talked about how he took the $500 the first month and to interview for a new job. And when he first told me that, I thought, why would you pay the interview? And he said, no, I don't get paid time off. I work hourly. For me to take time off of work to interview for a better job would mean losing a couple hundred dollars, and we live paycheck to paycheck, so I can afford to do that. But with the $500, I was able to do that, and now I have a better job. And then during COVID-19, a woman named Zane told me how before, because of the lack of federal response, we didn't have testing set up, that she was able to stay home when she had a cough and a fever instead of going to work because she knew that the $500 was coming to help her sort of mitigate any loss of income from following public health directives. And in doing so, save lives by not infecting others, because it turned out that she did, in fact, have COVID-19.
Wow. Where does the money come from for this? Is it from the local tax base, or does it come from other sources?
So in our pilot, because we talked about this in 2017, we launched 2019, and literally no one else in this country was doing it. So we were able to raise philanthropic dollars, notably from the Economic Security Project and its co-founder and co-chair, Chris Hughes, and the other foundations to pay for the research. But what we've seen in Mayors for Guaranteed Income is now mayors are using kind of CARES Act dollars and private dollars. And notably, I think Mayor Melvin Carter of St. Paul and his leadership with the People's Prosperity Pilot, where they're using CARES Act dollars. He actually got into it with his congresswoman about the use of CARES Act dollars, married with philanthropic dollars to make sure people have their needs met during this time. And even in Stockton, we were able to do one-time direct cash payments to people who lost their income due to COVID using public dollars. So it's been amazing to see sort of how the conversation has shifted from it having to be privately funded to folks using public dollars to invest directly in the people who make the public dollars possible.
I was just going to ask you about the funding. I mean, it can be great to have philanthropic dollars, but those dollars can dry up, depending on which way, things are headed. And so they're not necessarily the most stable. Is there any thought about restructuring taxes so that wealthier Americans might be putting in, dollars towards their surrounding communities, perhaps? Or is that just too far to think about?
Absolutely, they should. Particularly when we know that the richest among us are 40% richer during this pandemic, while other people are laid off and unemployed.
And there are people, Michael, as you know, that would argue that they deserve to be there. They worked really hard, quote unquote. And taxes is a really sensitive issue, as you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the hardest working people I know are the essential workers, are the nurses, are the migrant field workers, are the parents, notably mothers, who are doing school teaching via Zoom at home while trying to work, while taking care of domestic work. So folks will have a conversation about hard work and rewarding them with wages. I think that's one really in favor of a guaranteed income. But there's actually bills in Congress, even before this pandemic. Now Vice President, then Senator Kamala Harris, had a bill that would reverse the $2 trillion in Trump tax cuts. And in doing so, would provide $500 a month to every American family making $125,000 or less as a form of an EITC expansion.
That would be the earned income tax credit.
Senator Markey had a bill right now in Congress that speaks to $2,000 a month in COVID stimulus payments. You have a bunch of House of Representatives from Rep. Tlaib to Rep. Omar to Rep. Ryan and Rep. Khanna and others who have bills talking about reforming the tax code to provide an income floor for all people. So there's actually literally legislation now that can be enacted to get us there. I think that was just a question of continuing to build political will.
Do you suspect that political will happen?
I'm going to work as hard as I can with others to make it happen. So we'll see.
Michael Tubbs is the former mayor of Stockton, California, and the founder of Mayors for a Guaranteed Income. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been looking this hour at the momentum around policies like universal basic income and guaranteed income, which involve direct cash payments from government agencies to constituents. Last summer, polling from the Pew Research Center found that a little more than half of the people in the United States are opposed to the idea of universal basic income at the federal level, while about 45% support the policy. We wanted to hear from you on this and whether you support a universal basic income.
This is Alejandro in San Diego. I support UBI because our means of production have gotten more efficient due to outsourcing, automation, and economies of scale. These efficiencies have led to corporations and a handful of ultra-wealthy individuals holding on to a larger proportion of our nation's wealth, in effect keeping money out of the economy. Even as a self-proclaimed capitalist, I must acknowledge the harm this increased concentration of wealth has on people. UBI can serve as a counter to this.
This is Preston in Dallas, Texas. Universal basic income is worth pursuing. Give people the ability to get what they need, and they will work to get what they want. Hard to pursue happiness if you're desperate.
This is Barbara in San Jose. Guaranteed incomes sounds like a band-aid for a wound that will never heal. Let's tap innovators to identify new kinds of jobs. Jobs give people pride and self-sufficiency, not handouts.
My name is Bitty, and I'm calling from Manhattan. I support universal basic income because I think of it as an investment in our community. For a practical reason, I think that it would end up actually saving taxpayer dollars. I also think it would be a beneficial thing for us to destigmatize government aid.
This is Cheryl from Arlington, Texas. While it would be nice to be guaranteed an income, I have to keep asking, who's going to pay for this? And how far along the road to socialism or communism are we willing to go when we live in a democracy? If people want a guaranteed income, I would suggest they get themselves an education and a job. And let me also add that we currently have a guaranteed income for those in need. It's called welfare.
This is Dan in Longmont, Colorado. I think that having a universal basic income is the only logical way for us to move forward. A lot of times that our capitalist system relies on inefficiencies, and we're going to come to a reckoning here where we're going to have a society where lots of people are unemployed or unable to be employed because there's just not the demand. And so we need to move beyond a system that demands that people have jobs to support themselves with healthcare, to support their families, and to be able to put food on the table.
This is Ray from Denver, Colorado. I don't agree with or support the policy of universal basic or guaranteed income, simply because I don't believe that the policy is rooted in sound economic thought. My belief is that you would just reset a baseline. You would see large amounts of inflation, and before long, everyone would be back to right where they started. I think a better solution is to figure out how to increase jobs, keep people working, and give them good, meaningful work.
Hi, I'm Doris Lynn in Freehold, New Jersey. We need universal basic income or some kind of guaranteed income because as technology advances, we will have more and more jobs being done by computers and machines that were previously done by people. This will have the effect of concentrating wealth in smaller numbers of people while the masses are unemployed or underemployed.
Thank you, as always, for weighing in. You can keep sharing your thoughts with us on a universal basic income and guaranteed income by recording a voice memo and sending it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com, or you can go to thetakeaway.org and click on Contact Us to record your answer straight into your computer or phone. Last week, the Biden administration announced it would be removing restrictions on $1.3 billion in aid to protect the island of Puerto Rico against future climate disasters. The Biden administration will also loosen Trump-era restrictions on an additional $4.9 billion in aid to the island. But while President Biden's steps to make more of these funds available could finally mean more progress post-Maria, a number of other long-standing issues indicate that Puerto Rico's economy will continue to struggle under the new administration. Joining me now is Francis Negron Muntaner, Latino Studies Professor at Columbia University. Francis, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Francis, Puerto Rico was supposed to get $20 billion from Congress initially. The figures that we're talking about only add up to $6.2 billion. What happened to the rest of the money?
Well, part of it was a number of restrictions that were placed on it, and also claims that they should not be dispersed because of Puerto Rico's government corruption and other reasons. But basically, the money has not gotten to Puerto Rico, and the money that has gotten to Puerto Rico has also faced increased scrutiny and added layers of documentation and reporting. So it has been very difficult to spend overall.
We mentioned that the Trump administration had placed restrictions on this aid, and part of the reason we understand that they were able to do that is because Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States and not a state. What's your assessment of that?
Well, I think there were other reasons why the Trump administration refused to release the funds that were necessary and already approved by Congress, and I would boil it down to three of them. One was the repeated stated view that Puerto Ricans were not really Americans or underserving in some way. As you recall, Trump said at some point that people in Puerto Rico presumed that the U.S. would stay there for a long time, aiding recovery, and that they were just waiting for them to be helped. And by the way, FEMA and other government organizations and entities actually stay in locations affected by hurricanes for years, sometimes more than 10 years. So that was actually a view that was not supported by the evidence. Another thing is that it seemed like punishing or being cruel to Puerto Rico seemed to be something that Trump was using to excite the base, who shared that view that the U.S. should not be helping Puerto Rico as if Puerto Rico was a foreign country. And the third thing is that, if you remember, there was also a lot of antipathy between Trump and some members of the Puerto Rico's political leadership that played out in the media. So all in all, the Trump administration was bent on not supporting Puerto Rico's recovery process.
And if we compare Puerto Rico's recovery from Hurricane Maria to other states to states like Texas and Florida, who were also struck by natural disasters in 2017, how would we assess that? I mean, Puerto Rico appears to still be way behind in its rebuilding.
It's an interesting question because definitely the federal government acted very quickly. Let's say in Houston, that was affected by Hurricane Harvey. At the same time, if you look at 3 years later, you'll see a lot of people in Houston saying that they feel abandoned by the government. And when you look closer at who is saying that, you'll notice that it's basically low-income Black and brown people, the same kind of people that the administration thought or thinks lives in Puerto Rico.
Do we know how the delay in recovery is affecting people on the island post-Maria so far? And we've got about 30 seconds, but we can pick this up in the next segment.
Yeah, tremendously. I mean, think about that. Puerto Rico has a $70 billion debt and had a $90 billion damage from the hurricane. So if we're talking that Puerto Rico has received or spent only a few million dollars, you see a huge disproportion between the need and the funds. So that translates into much higher rates of poverty, people still living in houses with tarps, and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, the situation is still dire, and you can see that symptomatic that people keep leaving the island. There's still blackout in the island and, you know, other symptoms of the ongoing process.
Francis, at the end of January, Biden signed an executive order that emphasized his support of the Jones Act. What's the Jones Act mean for Puerto Rico?
Well, basically what it does is that it forces Puerto Rico to use the merchant marine to transport everything that goes in and out of Puerto Rico, which makes everything more expensive and also curtails the ability of Puerto Rico to trade more favorably with other places. So the direct hit that people get from that is a much higher cost of living. And that's a symptom of something that we can summarize as releasing the fund is good and it should happen, but at the same time, it's far from enough. So what would be a more robust approach to the fact of these tremendous amount of need? Well, I think one of the things is that the administration has to look into is to support the auditing of the debt and explore the ways that the debt can pretty much be eliminated. There are so many signs that this debt is illegitimate and also linked to a very long process of colonial extraction on the part of the U.S. and its corporations. The Jones Act, repealing the Jones Act, or at least exempting the Jones Act for Puerto Rico would also greatly help. creating a public Puerto Rico-led process of decolonization and addressing the debt and eliminating PROMESA would give back Puerto Ricans governance of its own island. And there is precedent for this. Well, for instance, parity with Medicare and Medicaid and other federal programs, so-called Marshall Plan to rebuild Puerto Rico in a better way. I mean, these are all proposals that are contained in legislation that has been proposed by Sanders and Warren. Also, a recent Ocasio and Velasquez legislation called Puerto Rico Self-Determination Act. So these are not necessarily new ideas. They just have not been picked up by Obama's administration or Trump's administration, and to date, not Biden's administration.
These ideas are also sort of teetering at the edges of what Puerto Rico is, its status, whether it is in a colonial relationship as it stands right now, which is this sort of strange binary of free associated state, or whether it becomes an independent nation or whether it becomes a state. Last September, candidate Biden at the time released a plan saying that as president, he would, quote, work with representatives who support each of the status options in Puerto Rico. Francis, do you think there is momentum right now around statehood or independence and whether or not the Biden administration will lean into that either way?
I mean, my impression so far is that Biden's not going to get too deep into it. The things that he has said specifically has been one, that he personally favors statehood. He has also said that he favors the creation of yet another task force to study the matter. There have been so many task forces to study the matter. I don't think we need more of that. And I don't think we necessarily need the president to support one thing or the other. I think what we need is Puerto Ricans to be able to set up a process through which they lead their own self-determination.
How realistic is that given everything that's happening on the island, though, Francis?
Well, you know, there's a lot of signs that people are ready for that. Immediately after the protests of 2019 against Ricardo Rosselló that culminated in his expulsion, basically, from the governor's mansion, there were assemblies that took place in many places of the island where people gathered to discuss the problems that Puerto Rico had and attempted to bring some consensus to how to address them. There are also a number of proposals in Puerto Rico to create a constituent assembly, which would follow a similar process of people getting together, creating a roadmap for this process. So I do believe people are ready. What I also think, though, is that people in Puerto Rico, or a lot of them, are not necessarily thinking in that binary, independence or statehood, but really want to go into a process where people have an opportunity to think through. What has been the experience? What are the opportunities? What are the options? What is the best for us? That process has never really happened. And in a way, Francis, I think it's as important the process to happen as the outcome is.
In terms of, you mentioned Obama's administration, obviously President Biden was then Vice President Biden. Was there anything that you saw under the Obama administration that you would recommend the Biden administration steer clear of or lean into in how it dealt with Puerto Rico?
I think the Obama administration was very harsh on Puerto Rico, either by what it did do and what it didn't do. So on what it did do was PROMESA. Which, as we know, created a 7-member control board that has practical veto power over decisions made by elected officials that, by and large, is working on behalf of bondholders, not the people of Puerto Rico. And there's many signs of that, the closing of hundreds of schools, the war on the University of Puerto Rico and public education more generally. And also Obama's investment in Puerto Rico, minimal, the only thing he did during his time was visit Puerto Rico for a few hours to raise money in a place that couldn't even vote for president. So I would say that Biden needs to move away from the Obama administration's attitude toward Puerto Rico and be closer to the type of work that Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Nidia Velasquez are doing.
Is there any indication so far? I mean, President Biden has met with people who he expects to work with on the issues regarding Puerto Rico right now. Is there any indication that he might be doing that move away from PROMESA and others?
I have not seen that yet, but I certainly hope that that's what happens. And to make it happen, people need to continue to press for their concerns and mobilize. I don't think it's going to happen any other way.
Francis Negron Muntaner is a Latino studies professor at Columbia University. Francis, always great to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. 2020 saw record high gun sales in the United States. Firearm purchases peaked after the start of state lockdowns in March, and then again during the summer's racial justice uprisings. And the pace appears to be continuing this year, with January 2021 gun sales reaching the third highest recorded one-month total. And while the face of the gun rights movement tends to be white conservatives, Black Americans are also contributing to the recent gun industry boom. According to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, gun sales by Black men and women rose 58% in the first half of 2020 compared to the first half of 2019. The choice that some Black Americans are making to arm themselves is part of a long, complicated history that our next guest has studied closely. Gerald Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Gerald, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's take it way back to the 1700s when white colonists created the Second Amendment. How did their views on Black and Indigenous people factor into that?
There was a real fear that the major challenge to security would be a slave insurrection coupled with a foreign invasion and or an Indian uprising. You saw a glimpse of that during the War of 1812. Recall that the last time the Capitol was invaded, a la January 6, 2021, was in August 1814, when British redcoats invaded the Capitol, sending James Madison and his spouse Dolly fleeing into the streets. And they were joined, that is to say, the redcoats were joined by enslaved Africans who then fled on British boats to Trinidad and Tobago, a British possession, where their descendants continued to reside. And this was not necessarily unique nor unusual during the early history of the United States of America, nor the colonial period for that matter.
Gerald, it's often noted that Harriet Tubman carried a gun for self-defense. What role did firearms play in slave rebellions and the abolitionist movement?
Well, it played a role during the Nat Turner Revolt of 1831 in Virginia. But keep in mind that the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, now considered to be hallowed language, did not apply to the enslaved population, nor did it apply to the indigenous population. In fact, a strategic objective of the settlers was to keep arms out of the hands of the Black population and the Indian population. However, after slavery was abolished post-1865, a strategic objective of the Ku Klux Klan and those who backed them was likewise to keep arms out of the hands of Black people, who then had the right to vote, at least for a limited period of time.
Let's fast forward a little bit to the gun ownership issue and how it played out in post-slavery era, particularly when we're talking about the lead up to the civil rights movement of the 1960s.
Well, keep in mind that the anti-lynch crusader, Ida B. Wells Barnett, a famed journalist in the post-Civil War era, counseled that Black people, to protect themselves from lynching, should have rifles. W.E.B. Du Bois, a founder of the NAACP in 1909, counseled likewise. A rather important event took place in Houston, Texas, August 1917, when Black soldiers who were about to be dispatched south of the border into rebellious and revolutionary Mexico objected to Jim Crow here in Houston and shot up the town. And that led to even more searching critiques of why Black men in particular should be allowed to be armed, even if they were operating within the confines of the U.S. military.
Gerald, up until this point, a lot of what you're describing is a history of, and I've reported on this myself, a history of Black gun ownership that goes underreported, particularly in our schools. Why is that?
Well, I think it's a very sensitive issue. As you know, more than most, since you've reported on it, that even the National Rifle Association, which considers the Second Amendment to be holy writ, oftentimes wilts when it comes to protecting the Second Amendment rights of Black Americans. I'm sure you recall the case a few years ago of Philando Castile in Minnesota when he was shot on Facebook Live as he was telling an officer, "Officer, I have a weapon in my glove compartment," and that tended to freak out the officer, who proceeded to kill him on the spot as his partner and her daughter were watching. I think that that particular episode illustrates the nervousness that comes into play when the idea of Black Americans with arms comes into play.
One of the visuals that I think many Americans are more familiar with are the Black Panthers and their relationship with firearms. How did they, you know, we see a lot of folks, we've been talking about how the insurrection has really shown how white Americans, are treated, who are protesting and really just insurrecting, you know, the Capitol. And if that had been Black or brown people, the reaction would have been much different. We also see many images of white Americans, militia members walking around openly with firearms, large firearms strapped to themselves. Kyle Rittenhouse, who killed two people, is one of the people I think about who also had a firearm. So when we see, we don't see Black and brown people afforded that same type of luxury. And the Black Panthers were no different. Is that right?
That is correct. Recall that it was the 1960s and the California state capital of Sacramento. And consonant with the law, the Black Panthers entered the legislative chambers armed. This outraged and infuriated the then governor, Reagan. It also did not necessarily cause, once again, the National Rifle Association to rally to their support and defend their Second Amendment rights. Once again, I think that it was appropriate for us to begin with slavery because we need to realize that there has been enslavement of Africans on North American soil much longer than non-enslavement. And when you talk about enslavement of Africans, you talk about fear that this bonded population would rise up, and that leads to a certain kind of nervousness and insecurity about this population across the board, not least when they have weapons in their hands.
What do we think is leading to the spike in gun sales that we've seen among Black men and women in particular this past year?
Well, I think people are reading the newspapers and listening to programs like yours. What I mean is you see all these headlines about white supremacists infiltrating police departments, infiltrating the U.S. military. In fact, the U.S. military is about to, already has undergone a pause led by the newly appointed chief of the Pentagon, General Lloyd Austin, to deal with white extremists within their ranks. And if you feel that the police department will not necessarily protect you, then you feel that you must protect yourself. And certainly that's the lesson I would imagine that the family of Philando Castile is seeking to digest, not to mention the lesson that the family of the late Botham Jean has digested. Recall that a few years ago in Dallas, a police department officer mistakenly entered his apartment and shot him because she thought that he had invaded her apartment. She was a nearby neighbor. And so all of these stories and headlines induces a certain kind of insecurity that leads to buying of weapons.
Gerald Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Thanks so much, Gerald.
Thank you.
That's all we have for you on this Monday, folks. Thanks, as always, for spending part of your day with us. And of course, if you have any thoughts or ideas for the show, send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm at Tanzina Vega. And we also take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or you can call us the old-fashioned way at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Leave us your take there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.